Hi, I'm WTOP Entertainment Editor Jason Fraley, and I'm here with
Beth Anderson from the Avalon Theater.
And I'm so excited for this because this festival scratches me right where I itch. This is the Hitchcock Truffaut Film Festival over at the Avalon. You guys have probably passed it. I think it's the oldest theater in D.C.
It's the oldest movie theater in D.C. that's still operating.
Yes, and you guys have passed it. It's over right by Chevy Chase Circle. It's a great area. Grab a bite to eat around there and then come in for one of these screenings. So tell me, I guess, first of all, how did you come up with the idea to do the Hitchcock Truffaut Festival?
Well, first off, the Avalon Theater is a nonprofit theater, the only nonprofit in D.C. And so every year we do this benefit to help raise money for our programs, like our film education programming. And so we do a different thing each year. We always try to find something that's fun and also kind of educational for the audience. And this Hitchcock Truffaut movie had come out recently, and we saw it. We all thought it was great. And we said, you know, Hitchcock is one of the greatest filmmakers of all time. And so let's do this film for our benefit event. And then, of course, once we started talking about it, we thought, oh, this would be a great opportunity to show all these Hitchcock movies in the theater and let people come see them. So, you know, we picked 7 films, 6 Hitchcock, 1 Truffaut, and we'll be showing them in the theater for 3 days before the benefit.
As well as the documentary Hitchcock Truffaut.
As well as the documentary on Sunday, May 8th.
That's so awesome. I guess so people understand what we're talking about here if they're not familiar, although I'm sure a lot of movie buffs, this is sort of textbook stuff here. I mean, the Hitchcock Truffaut, I think it was in 1962.
Mm-hmm.
Truffaut, who is, you know, I guess he had just come out on the scene because I think he and Godard and Alain René and all them came out around 1959 with the French New Wave after Cahiers du Cinéma. And he reaches out to Alfred Hitchcock, who's this massive, you know, star in Hollywood at this point, and says, I want to interview you. I guess a lot of this hadn't really been done before, at least the deconstructing the shots and everything.
Right. Truffaut wrote Hitchcock this beautiful letter that Hitchcock said brought tears to his eyes and said that he wanted to put together this book. And part of the reason was because people didn't really take Hitchcock seriously at the time as a really serious
craftsman. They thought he was a commercial master of suspense, but not an artistic genius.
Right. And so Truffaut came in to talk to him about all of his films, interviewed him in depth about really the craftsmanship and how the films were put together. And then he put it in this book along with photos, you know, that were shot by shot, laying out of all these amazing things that he had done. And it really changed Hitchcock's reputation.
That's awesome. And thank God for that, right? Because now he's looked back as, you know, right up there with the Orson Welles and Kubrick. I mean, he's probably above all of them. He's probably the greatest filmmaker ever made. It's funny how Truffaut sort of saw that early.
Right. It was sort of Truffaut's mission to, you know, make everyone else see that as well.
That's awesome. And now Avalon's making everyone else see it as well. Okay, so there is this documentary, Hitchcock Truffaut, that is going to be playing Sunday, May 8th. We'll get that at the end of the interview, but let's sort of move chronologically through the screenings we have here, if you don't mind. On Thursday, you guys are opening up strong out of the box. We got Rear Window at 3 p.m. If you guys haven't seen this, gotta see it. Tell them, I could go ramble on and on, but tell them a little bit about what Rear Window is, just the main plot summary, Jimmy Stewart in the wheelchair, all that stuff.
Right. So Jimmy Stewart is a photographer who's broken his leg on a shoot, and he's stuck in his apartment, and he has nothing to do except watch all of his neighbors across the way. And as he's watching them, he thinks that he sees a murder.
Thorwalds.
Yes, the Thorwalds.
Thorwald.
And she's in bed, complains a lot, and one night she kind of disappears.
And with a shriek in the night.
Right. And so Jimmy Stewart has to convince everyone, including his girlfriend, played by Grace Kelly, that a murder has happened, and you know, all while sitting in his apartment. And things get scary and tense, and things go from there.
Just alone, by that summary alone, it's this great white knuckle thrill ride, you know, because you have Miss Lonely Hearts down in a window getting ready to overdose on sleeping pills, and then right above her, there, you know, Grace Kelly's about to be found by Mr. Thorwald. So there's great, you know, suspense moments too, probably more suspenseful than most any other movie you can think of. But sort of on a deeper level, if you really want to look at it, it symbolizes the filmmaking process, right? Like sort of each window is like, you know, Jimmy Stewart looking out that rear window is almost like he's a director cutting from image to image looking at the window.
Right.
So it works sort of on that really deep level too. It's an amazing movie.
Right. And there's this subplot where Grace Kelly wants to marry Jimmy Stewart, and all the people that Jimmy Stewart sees out the window are in various stages of romance, you know, from sort of the newlywed phase to the maybe not so newlywed phase. And so he's sort of, you know, trying to figure that out as well.
Yeah, I think it's one of the most genius things about the movie is the sort of, I guess, the overall theme, right? And Thelma Ritter tells him it, and Grace Kelly tells him it, but it's sort of like we need to, you know, you spend so much time looking outside, but really he has Grace Kelly right behind him, you know, right, making him all these meals. But I love it's a genius point that you had about how all the different neighbors symbolize something. You know, because you have the old bickering couple that drops the dog down.
Right,
you have the
right,
starving artist on the piano, which he might be if his photographer career goes.
Right.
There's, of course, the sexual desire, like the playboy, the ballerina.
Mm-hmm. There's a newlywed couple.
And the newlywed couple with the shade drawn.
Right, right.
And then Miss Lonely Hearts, too. And mm-hmm. then there's the Thorwalds, which is the ultimate, you know, domestic violence murder.
Right, right.
So it's a pretty genius way of showing what's going on in Jimmy's internal battle on whether to settle down. And if you look really close, not only do we see POVs of each of these characters,
right,
Hitchcock will swing the camera so that those characters are in the background at opportune moments.
Mm-hmm.
So I think there's a scene when Grace Kelly's making Jimmy Stewart dinner. It's like lobster or something. He says, it's perfect. It's always
right,
perfect.
It's always perfect.
When they're sort of talking in a two-shot and the ballerina is in the background when they're sort of talking about the single playboy life.
Mm-hmm.
And the second that Grace Kelly says, don't you think you want to settle down, Jeff? Hitchcock swings the camera around. And so you have the married couple with the shade drawn right behind them.
Right.
That is mise-en-scene at its best, baby.
Right.
I love it. Okay, we could go on forever about it. But why should they come see it? If they haven't seen it or if they have seen it a million times, why should they come?
Well, I think this film in particular is so great to see in a big screen. If you've only seen this movie at home on your TV, you will be blown away if you come and see it in a theater because there is so much going on in the background, like you just said, that you won't really be able to notice that well unless you're seeing it on a big screen.
Right.
And Hitchcock built this amazing set, you know, with all these apartments, and just to come see it kind of in our historic theater in its glory on a big screen, I think, is something everybody should do.
Yeah, in the big screen, and to be able to, you know, like you're saying, if you've seen it before, you've probably noticed a lot of the plot stuff, but now come back
right,
again, because this sucker repays over and over again, absolutely. Especially that, before we move on, that opening sequence. Where it's like he tells so much with while Jimmy Stewart's asleep and he
right,
moves around,
and the camera's just moving around, and you're getting the whole story.
Yeah, you got the sweat bead dropping. You got here lies the broken leg of LB Jeffries. You see his photographer. You saw how he got the broken leg with the photos. You see Grace Kelly in the negative.
Right.
It says so much. It's genius. Come out and see. Okay, next we have at 5:30 on Thursday, The 39 Steps. Was this a personal favorite choice of yours?
I do like The 39 Steps, and it was, we also wanted to choose Hitchcock films from his whole career, and so we wanted to cover, you know, as many decades as we could. And so this was a film that he made in the 30s before he came to the United States. And it's also a film that a lot of people say is kind of the first Hitchcock film because it has a Hitchcock blonde, and it has some comedy, and it's got sort of the wrong man
right,
who's pulled into a mystery, and a lot of things that Hitchcock returned to in later films as well.
Yeah, I don't know if it was the exact first, but it was the first really great example of that wrong man idea, and he went on to make that again and again. I think it was one called The Wrong Man,
mm-hmm.
But then, of course, probably most famously, North by Northwest.
Right.
Over and over again, he returned to that. So it's nice to sort of see the roots of that here.
Right.
1935, Great Britain, black and white,
mm-hmm.
sort of on the run with... It's Robert Donat who made...
Right.
It was Goodbye, Mr. Chips right after that,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, it's a great little flick. After that, you close out. So after you watch Rear Window and 39 Steps, stay for 7:45 p.m. on Thursday for one of my all-time favorites, Notorious.
Yes.
Yes.
Notorious was also a personal favorite of mine as well, and it's a movie I could watch again and again with Ingrid Bergman and Cary Grant, and some really amazing shots in the film as well, just kind of classic Hitchcock moments.
Yeah. Give them the rundown of what it's at, you know, go into how she falls for Claude Rains in Brazil.
Right, so Ingrid Bergman's character is the daughter of a former Nazi spy, and Cary Grant works for the CIA, I think, and they sort of recruit her to... date, and eventually she marries a former Nazi who's living in South America, and they think that he's up to some shenanigans, and they want to find out what it is. And so she goes and you know, ends up in this man's home and finds that he is, I think it has something to do with uranium. And yeah, so
one of the MacGuffins.
But she and Cary Grant also fall in love with each other as well. And so, you know, she's in this terrible situation and Cary Grant is kind of torn between, you know, his duty to his country and his love for Ingrid Bergman.
It's a great movie. You mentioned that there's some amazing shots. I have a couple of my favorites, but do you have a favorite?
Yes, I love the scene where Ingrid Bergman is trying to sneak a key to Cary Grant. And she's at a party, she's down at the bottom of this huge staircase, and the camera starts at the very top of the staircase and slowly zooms in to the key in her hand as she's sort of going through the party and trying to pass it off to Cary Grant without being discovered.
I think it's one of the most daring shots in movie history. It's this extreme high angle of this party, lavish party going on that very deep in the background in the bottom of the frame. And then it just cranes all the way down from this extreme high angle to this extreme close-up of the key. And, you know, Ingrid gives that little flash where you can kind of see it a little bit, see the key in the hand. But then from that, I mean, that whole sequence when they go down into the wine cellar and you're cutting back and forth to see the wine bottles slowly, you know, disappearing out. So you know that Cary Grant and Ingrid are down in the basement looking for the uranium, I think it is, right? In the wine bottles. But then you're cross-cutting that with upstairs with the wine running out. So you know Claude Rains is going to come catch him, but down below, and it's just, again, like Rear Window.
The
it's
whole
one of
scene
the most
is very tense.
Thing. Yeah, it's amazing. And then they start drugging her, and you get those big close-ups on the cup where they're poisoning her. Oh, it's just amazing. It's amazing. And then tell them about, I'm sure you know, they couldn't, I think there was some Hays Code rules right at the time where they couldn't show kisses for certain long. So go into that great scene.
Yeah, so early in the film, there's this incredible love scene between Ingrid Bergman and Cary Grant. And I believe at the time you couldn't show people kissing for more than 2 or 3 seconds at a time. So what Hitchcock did was have them sort of snuggle and break apart every few seconds and sort of whisper sweet nothings and then come back together for more kissing. So the whole scene is, you know, 2.5 minutes long, but he never at any point, you know, went over the line in terms of the 2 or 3 second rule.
And it's bizarre, but in a weird way, isn't it almost sexier and more delicious, you know, and steams up the screen almost more than an explicit, you know, scene in a lot of today's movies? For some reason, that like cat and mouse give and take, push and pull of them like being an inch from each other's lips. Oh my God, maybe it's just because it's Cary Grant and Ingrid Bergman.
I think it's one of the most romantic scenes in the movies.
Oh, it's fantastic. You got to go see it. I'm sure a lot of you have seen Psycho and North by Northwest and stuff, but go see Notorious if you haven't. It's a gem. 1946, right? I think it was his last produced by Selznick, I believe.
I think that's right.
I believe. Yeah, he came over here. Rebecca, he won Best Picture for Rebecca.
Right.
And then this was shortly after, but yeah, it's a great movie. Okay, cool. Let's see. All right, so we made it through Thursday. We'll have to probably go a little faster than this. But some of them re-screen, right? So, okay, so then Friday, May 6th, let's say you missed Thursday, come out Friday, 12:15 p.m., North by Northwest. Probably the most entertaining, straight, pure entertainment of Hitchcock's movies. Explain what this sucker's about. Masterpiece.
So in this film, Cary Grant plays an advertising executive who sort of stumbles into...
A Don Draper from the 50s, right?
Right. Stumbles into this meeting where he's mistaken for a spy and starts being chased all over the country by these very bad men. And James Mason is a villain who's great. And then the CIA comes in and says, oh, this spy doesn't actually exist.
Kaplan.
And we'd like you to just pretend to be him for a couple of days and try not to get killed.
Yeah.
And so he goes on this. He's chased across the country, which is where the North by Northwest title comes from.
Right. And where South by Southwest gets its title from for the film fest. They pulled it from the movie. It's so awesome. Then you have Ava Marie Saint, too, who's the blonde.
Right, spy who, you know, they sort of develop a romance.
Lots of double and triple crosses. That scene with them on the train, too, flirting when he's, like, trying to be disguised, but she sees through it is fantastic. The most famous probably is obviously the climax on Mount Rushmore, right?
Right, right. But also the crop duster scene.
Oh, yeah, though, of course. Yeah, okay. You go out and try to make a movie that has one legendary scene. This movie has two, okay? Cary Grant getting chased by the crop duster out at a crossroads in the middle of, I don't even know where we are, the Midwest somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
And it's all, talk about how it's all told visually, too, because he's standing there glancing left, glancing right. Cars mm-hmm. pull up. He thinks it's his ride. It's not. Then this plane starts bearing down on him. Tell him how it's sort of all visually done, how genius that is.
Right. There's this amazing buildup where he's just looking around and kind of sees the plane, and the plane kind of looks suspicious, and then, you know, cuts back to him, and he realizes that the plane is coming for him, and he's, you know, running away and you know, diving into the bushes, and it just sort of slowly builds up this suspense. And there's also all these shots of, I mean, it's this open field. There's literally nowhere for him to hide.
Right.
And it's really, really tense and terrifying.
It's one of the great scenes ever. And probably, I mean, Cary Grant's best movie, I would think. I mean, it's hard to say. God, His Girl Friday and a bunch of others, Bringing Up Baby. But this one, to me, if I think of, close my eyes and think of Cary Grant, you think of him running away from that plane, don't you think?
Mm-hmm.
And then probably the underrated scene, my personal favorite, at least from a comedy standpoint, that auction scene where he has to figure out how to get out of the auction. And well, we don't want to spoil it for everybody. Go see it. But it is hysterical. I that's one of those laugh out loud moments for me. Or when he's drunk in the beginning, that's also laugh out loud hilarious.
Yeah, and there's so much comedy in Hitchcock films. I think people overlook that a little bit, but he really does work in some just hilarious stuff.
Yeah, and then there also, I mean, one of those great Bernard Herrmann scores, too, with the mm-hmm. and the opening credits up against the side of the building,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, it's a little Mad Men foreshadowing that in Vertigo. You combine those paper cutouts falling with the North by Northwest building, there you get the opening of Mad Men. It all comes from Hitchcock. Okay, awesome. And then at 3:15, we get Notorious again, in case you missed it, Thursday. And then at 5:45, a great movie, Rope. 1948. Go into how it's a single take masterpiece.
Right. So this was a kind of experimental film by Hitchcock, and he decided he wanted to shoot this story and make it look like the entire thing was one take.
One continuous long shot. Yeah.
And so at the time, I think you could shoot maybe 10 or 11 minutes on one reel of film. And so he had to find ways to sort of mask that he was changing the film without making it look like he interrupted the shot. So he would sort of, you know, turn the camera and point it at something that was
like
black,
the back shirt of a guy,
right,
or something.
The back of a chair or something,
yeah.
And then, you know, and then zoom back out, and that would be when the film was switched. And he also built this incredible set. He had to do all of these things to mask the sound of the camera moving,
right,
and make sure the lights were all coming on and off. And so it was actually quite a technical feat behind the scenes to pull this off.
Yeah, I mean, you get, Birdman, great flick. And Victoria was last year a great film. You get all these modern day movies that get all this praise, and rightfully so, for pulling off these elaborate single takes throughout the entire movie. But to sit and think that this was 1948, what is
right,
like 67 years before all these movies were being done, and like you're saying, all the other logistical problems they would have had to go through, covering up the sound, and you know, and coming up with clever ways to wipe, you know, when the film was running out. You know, it's really an amazing technical piece.
Right, you didn't have computers to sort of clean everything up at the end like
Steadicams
you do today.
To, you know, balance it out and smooth it out. You were actually dialing from place to place around this apartment that he made. It's amazing. And then even, so aside from that, it's just an awesome, you know, suspenseful tale, because you have these two guys who, and I think there's like a little homoerotic undertones too, if you look back at it again, but be that as it may, there's these two guys who decide, oh, it'll be fun to kill a guy with a rope, right? They strangle him. That's how the movie opens. That's not a spoiler. That's literally like the opening shot. And they were like, let's have a party. Let's put him in a box and drape a cloth over it as it's a table, and let's throw a party around it.
Right.
And Jimmy Stewart comes as a detective, as a guest to the party, and we'll see if we get caught. I mean, don't you want to see that? I mean, it's amazing.
Right. They think this makes them superior to have pulled off this murder, and so then they're going to, you know, continue that by having this dinner party. And one of the two is not so okay with it, and as the movie goes on, he gets more and more nervous, and you know, there's some tension there. Not only is someone going to discover this body, but is this guy going to, you know, crack and spill the beans?
Is it Farley Granger?
Mm-hmm.
Is the one that was in Strangers on a Train?
Right,
So this would have been three. This is pre-Strangers on a Train. This is 3 years prior to that.
Right.
Yeah. Wow. It's a great movie. And it's probably one of those that a lot of people haven't seen that often. I feel like it doesn't get, you know, it doesn't make the rounds as often. It's one of those, I wouldn't, not necessarily a hidden gem, but it's a really great, great movie. Okay. And then, of course, probably his pop culture most famous one at 8 p.m. Friday, the one and only Psycho, right?
Right.
Go. I mean, does this need an introduction? Do we have to? All right. Give the obligatory plot summary.
So Psycho, Janet Leigh plays a woman who works in an insurance agency, and she's seeing this man and she wants to marry him, but he has all this alimony, doesn't feel like he can marry her. And she has the opportunity to take some cash. And so she does. She steals some money and she's going to run off with him, and she's driving away and gets caught in a storm and has to stop at this motel. And it's run by this man named Norman Bates, played by Anthony
Perkins. Bates Motel. You may have heard of it.
And he he has some issues. And
he's a big mama's boy. Let's say that.
I feel like I can't give it away.
We can't. I mean, when this movie came out, right? They locked the doors. And right. It was, you know, back in the day, you'd stumble in and out of matinees and you'd come in mid-movie. But right. This was like the first one, I believe. They locked the doors and they said, you're not allowed to tell the ending of the movie. Hitchcock went and bought a bunch of copies of the book of the movie. They had casting sessions for Mrs. Bates. All of this was shrouded in the secrecy. So you went in there and you said, what is going on here in this movie? We're talking like it's a spoiler alert. It's probably the greatest twist in movie history. But you know what? Some things need to be protected. Maybe there's some young person who's never seen it. So we're not going to say.
Yes.
But Norman Bates, one of the greatest characters in movie history. And I think we can discuss the shower scene, right?
It's
famous. Come on. All right. We're not going to spoil the ending, even though everyone knows it. But the shower scene, right? So let's talk about how sort of genius from a narrative standpoint that is, because you're about, you know, a third into the movie, you're following Janet Leigh, Marion Crane, as the main character of this. What is going on with this money? You know, is she going to return it? Is she going to run off with her lover, Gavin, John Gavin? And then all of a sudden, she is offed in a shower in a brutal way, even though you don't see the knife actually go in her. Hitchcock's genius with the way he cuts that. But just from a narrative standpoint, how ballsy is that to just offer a third into the movie?
Right. And Hitchcock really wanted to do this where he would get you really sucked into what you think is one story, and then he just pulls the rug out from under you and totally changes everything up. And then also does it in this really scary, horrifying way that's going to scare the bejesus out of you.
I've been told that at the premiere, I think it was at Radio City, maybe, that you couldn't hear, you know, the famous slashing score by Bernard Herrmann, the wink, 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 which everyone knows. I was told you couldn't even hear that score in the premiere because people were screaming so loud. Like, you couldn't even hear it. People were freaking out. Because this is your main character. This has never happened before.
Right.
You know, nowadays we have Game of Thrones when anyone can get whacked. You know, Ned Stark's gone after season one or whatever. But this was very groundbreaking and probably the first mainstream horror movie, first slasher movie.
Right. There's so many films now that use this that, you know, it's easy to forget that, like, literally no one had seen this type of film before until Hitchcock did it.
Yeah. So put yourself in those shoes. Put on your 1960 goggles, if you will, and sort of think in those terms. And just, you know, suddenly she's gone, and then we realize, oh, this Norman Bates character is the character that we're supposed to follow this whole time. And as that car's sinking with her body in the trunk, and it sort of stops, we hold our breaths, and then as it sinks the rest of the way, we sort of smile and sigh of relief. And I think in that moment, Hitchcock has us. We're complicit with the murder of Marion. And if you really could step back from your own body and examine your viewing habits at that moment, it's sort of a very interesting thing that we are now on board with this killer.
Yeah, Hitchcock loved to manipulate the audience. And I mean, this was kind of the ultimate manipulation is in this movie.
Absolutely. And even, I mean, everyone remembers the slashing shower scene, right? Probably one of the, you know, if you had to make a list of the five most famous movie scenes, it's got to be in there. But I think the really genius thing is after it's over, when he comes out of there's that like spiral shot where they pull out of her, it's the shower drain, and then it becomes her eyeball, and then we slowly spin and pull out of her dead body laying on the floor. But then we get this, like, it's not a subjective or an objective camera. It's like a personified camera. Like, the camera's acting as its own viewer, and it moves from her eye to the money on the nightstand, right? It's like, all right, pay attention to this.
Right.
And then it moves to the window out so you can see the house, the famous scary house.
Right.
Mother, the blood. There's just some awesome stuff going on here. And I don't want to spoil the ending, obviously, but if you go back and look at it again, look when Norman Bates is meeting Marion outside, I guess it's the parlor, the cabin. There's an interesting, there's some mirror there's a window reflections right. for Norman Bates that are symbolic. The opening credits splitting apart are symbolic.
Right. I love the scene where Janet Leigh and Norman Bates are talking, and he seems like this very kind of normal, maybe awkward, mm-hmm. shy guy, but he... One of his hobbies is to stuff birds, and there are all these birds
scene, yeah.
hanging around, and the camera yeah. sort of focuses on them, and it yeah. creates this really creepy tension to the scene yeah. that maybe
That's
would get you to start yeah. thinking, like, oh, this guy might not be totally right.
Yeah, and so he says, a boy's best friend is his mother. That's right. a great scene. There's even that bizarre shot. I didn't even really... I guess I picked it up like probably the 10th time watching it or something because there's all this other great stuff. But there's that weird shot where it's like under his throat, like looking up at him as they're munching sandwiches in that scene. And it's almost like a little bird swallowing it. It's amazing. There's so much going on.
It's an incredible film.
It's an incredible film. We could talk forever about this movie. Okay. So that takes us through Friday. So, hey, we're giving this sucker its due, okay? This is the Hitchcock Truffaut Film Festival. You're going to hear all about this. All right. So Saturday, May 7th, 12:30 p.m., we get 39 Steps again. And then 2:30 p.m., we get the one, the Truffaut film, Jules and Jim. I believe it was 1962, I think.
I think that's right.
Explain what this one is about.
So Jules and Jim is about two men, Jules and Jim, but it's really about a woman
yeah.
Named Catherine, who's played by Jean Moreau. And they both fall in love with her, and which you might think would go a certain way, but this being France in the 60s, sure. I think goes maybe a little bit differently than you would expect. And it's about her relationship with the two of them sort of over the course of decades.
Yeah, and coming back to them and find, you know, or one comes back to her and sort of it's not...
She marries one, but
yeah.
maybe loves the other.
Right. And the one picks up on that later. Yeah, mm-hmm. it's pretty. It's if you want to see a really awesome love triangle, see this one. I mean, obviously, The Graduate's probably the most bizarre love triangle, but this one's right up. It's great. Tell me. I mean, there's so many great Truffaut films you could have picked. The 400 Blows was his breakthrough, right, in 59.
Mm-hmm.
I always love Day for Night, and that the
Day
cat
for Night's one of my favorite too.
Thing. It's just a great. That's like a great movie about movie making. Fahrenheit 451, right?
Mm-hmm.
He's made a bunch.
Mm-hmm.
And then the little, I love his little cameo in Close Encounters, Spielberg's Close Encounters.
Right.
Why of all of those, why did you guys say, you know what, we're picking this one?
You know, I think it's so romantic, and I think it's really encapsulates the new wave, which is this yeah. whole part of this whole filmmaking movement that mm-hmm. Truffaut was part of. And, you know, when I think of that period, that's kind of like the film that comes to mind. So right. I think we wanted to pick the one that kind of best represented that era.
Yeah, you can close your eyes. If you've seen it, you can close your eyes and picture them running down that, what do you call it, the overpass,
right,
the bridge?
Right,
or, yeah.
And she's in the crazy clothes with her pretend
yeah.
mustache. And,
yeah.
you know, it's just sort of the freedom and of the 60s and the way that cinema just changed at that moment. And a lot of it was due to the influence of Truffaut and these other French New Wave filmmakers.
Yeah, you think of that and, like, Godard's Breathless. Like, they're really sort of those iconic moments that symbolize the whole French New Wave.
Right.
Yeah.
And, like, if you look at American filmmaking after that point, a lot of the directors that we think of in the 70s, you know, you mentioned The Graduate,
yeah.
Scorsese, and, you know, Coppola, they were really yeah. influenced by this.
Talk about, I think that interplay between America and France is fascinating. It sort of starts, they named film noir. They watched all of our movies that were going on during the war that they hadn't seen because, you know, they were occupied by Nazi Germany.
Right.
So after World War II, right, they start getting, all these critics start, you know, going through all these great, you know, 40s American movies, and they find all these dark themes, and they call it film noir, right? So they all start writing about all these great filmmakers, as well as writing about Hitchcock and all, you mm-hmm. know, the studio system, in their own critic magazines, Cahiers du Cinéma and all this stuff. And then a bunch of them say, you know what? It's 1959. We critics at this magazine are going to become filmmakers ourselves.
Right.
And they invent the French New Wave. Explain, like, sort of what French New Wave was about, how it sort of broke rules.
Well, there were several ways. One of the things that they talk about and why they championed Hitchcock was this theory they had that was called auteur theory, that the director is really the author of the film and puts his stamp on the film. And in America, you had the studio system where it was all controlled by the studios, and they just thought of directors as people you hired.
Right.
And Truffaut and these other people said, no, like, the director is the one who makes his mark. And we're going to do that with our films. And it's going to be a reflection of who we are and our values. And Truffaut's first film was very autobiographical, The 400 Blows.
Right. The kid is, like, basically his childhood, right?
I mean, right. Yeah. Right. And then, you know, and then also there was a lot more freedom in terms of how the camera worked, maybe a lot more improvisation in terms of how scenes were written and shot. And so they kind of took this kind of factory filmmaking and just blew that apart.
Jump cutting all around. And then, like you said, it's funny. Like, so they took our Hollywood stuff, critiqued it, praised it, and then made their own thing called the French New Wave. And then, like you were saying, then it came back over here in, I'd say, the late 60s and through the 70s and created our Hollywood Renaissance.
Right.
The Scorsese's, Coppola's, everyone that you mentioned, Mike Nichols, I mean, all those. Mm-hmm. So what we consider as sort of this maverick era of blooming, flourishing, edgy filmmakers from the 70s, we kind of owe to Truffaut and those guys.
Absolutely.
Awesome. Okay, cool. So we got Jules and Jim at 2:30 p.m. Saturday. 5 p.m. you get North by Northwest again, in case you want to see the crop duster again. And then 8 p.m. we close out again with Rear Window again, in case you missed it on Thursday. And then so all that's building up. You've seen all these great movies. Tell us what then the big grand finale on Sunday.
So on Sunday, the Avalon is doing a benefit event to raise money for the theater, and we are showing the documentary Hitchcock Truffaut.
Which came out last year.
And so, you know, Truffaut conducted this intense series of interviews with Hitchcock in the 60s, and he published it in a book in 1966, and which was one of the most influential books on cinema. And last year, the director, Kent Jones, found the audio recordings from this and took those, and then also interviewed 10 filmmakers from around the world, people like David Fincher and Wes Anderson, to talk about you know, what this book and what this relationship between these two filmmakers and how that had influenced their career. And then he put all of that together in this film, along with scenes from, you know, Hitchcock and Truffaut's films that they talk about, and then put it together in this great documentary. And so we're showing that film at the Avalon's benefit. And then the director, Kent Jones, is coming, and he's going to be interviewed by Arch Campbell to talk about the film.
So awesome.
And his career and some of these great stories after we show the film.
We just had, I don't know if you saw it, we just had Arch Campbell in here the other day. And we talked to him for like an hour and a half. It was his 70th birthday yesterday. So we did a sort of look back movie memory lane. Arch, this is your life. But he's not done yet. He's still ready to go. And he's a great friend. And he's awesome. And he's the perfect guy to host this thing.
Right.
So he's gonna interview, like, Q&A with Kent Jones.
Right. He'll interview Kent Jones after the film. And then, we'll take questions from the audience. And the benefit supports the Avalon's programming, helps maintain our theater, particularly supports our film education programming for students and adults. So it's a great cause and an entertaining evening.
That's awesome. If you guys aren't psyched to go see this yet, then I don't know what I'll do it, because I these movies are awesome. My personal favorite's not on your list. I'm a Vertigo guy. How did that one not make the cut?
Well, it was hard. I mean, all of Hitchcock's films are so great. So narrowing it down was tough. We actually, the Avalon did Vertigo as our first film education program for adults just last year.
Oh, okay.
And
mix it up.
Since we'd shown it recently, we decided to mix it up.
Gotcha. Well, you can't go wrong with any of the ones you picked. They're all absolutely amazing.
They are fantastic.
They're great movies. So come out and see it. It's at the Avalon, right by Chevy Chase Circle. Thursday, May 5th through Sunday, May 8th. Explain how they can find ticket information and what it costs and all the particulars.
Right. So you can get all the information on our website at theavalon.org. You can buy tickets for the benefit. If you buy a higher level ticket to the benefit, You will get free admission to all of the festival films on Thursday through Saturday.
So it's like a whole festival pass.
Yes.
Interesting. Yes. And what are the tickets, if you don't mind me asking?
There are two levels of tickets. There's a $50 ticket, which is for the film screening and discussion afterwards, or a $250 ticket, which includes a reception beforehand and then the screening and discussion. And then, like I said, you will also get free admission to all the festival films.
And then and you can also go to pay for individual screens,
yes,
right?
Yes. So the films will also be open to the public at our regular ticket prices.
Right. And I know when you hear that, it's not like cheap, but it goes to a good cause. It's a nonprofit, right?
Exactly. So. We're a nonprofit, and so we rely on supporters from the community to help us maintain the theater and keep doing our great programming, including our film education programs.
Yeah. So if you like this simple notion of the oldest operating theater in DC showing Hitchcock and Truffaut movies and doing festivals like this where they get great filmmakers to come talk about their documentary, then it's just a great cause. Come out and plop down the money and see some great movies while you're at it. Thanks so much for coming in.
All right. Thank you so much.